Tonight, I want to announce that we're having a very special episode on the Pedagogy Non Grata podcast. So I am joined by four amazing scholars for a roundtable on reading comprehension. I have observed that the general impression of teachers and academics is that we have less of a scientific consensus on reading comprehension than we do on phonics and word reading. Moreover, I find myself concerned that sometimes discussions on reading comprehension are overly simplified. I was discussing this topic with Dr. Mitchell about this, and he suggests that we conduct a roundtable on the topic. All of the scholars tonight are very qualified and much more knowledgeable than myself, and I hope that by bringing them together, we can find common ground on the topic and provide teachers with practical recommendations on how to improve reading comprehension. Before we begin, I would like to introduce each of our speakers. I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order to avoid implying any sort of ranking. Now, I must admit these introductions are a bit long, and I apologize for that. However, each of these speakers has a very long list of impressive accomplishments, and I don't want to gloss over their qualifications for speaking on this topic. Dr. Mitchell Brookins is an educational consultant who supports teachers, school administrators, and district leaders in advancing student academic attainment. His 18 years of professional experience include teaching, instructional coach, school administrator, district leader, consultant, and educational thought leader in K-12. He's a professional learning facilitator for the National Board of Professional Teaching Standards, Letters Unbound, AIM Institute, New School for New Orleans, and a member of the board of directors for the Reading League. Finally, he's a managing director with Leading Educators Supporting Literacy Professional Development Systems in Baltimore City Schools. Dr. Jennifer Buckingham is the Director of Strategy and Senior Research Fellow at MultiLit, Director of the 5 from 5 Project. Jennifer is the founder of 5 from 5 Project, which provides evidence-based information on effective reading instruction. Her PhD research was on effective instruction for struggling readers. She has a profound advice on reading instruction curriculum and policy to the NSW, Victorian, South Australian, and federal governments, and was the chair of the expert advisory group to the federal government on a year one literacy and numeracy assessment. Jennifer works with systems, schools, and teachers to improve literacy instruction and assessment. She is a board member of the Australian Institute for Teaching and School Leadership, an affiliate member of the La Trobe University Solar Lab, and a member of the National Catholic Education Commission Standing Committee on Educational Excellence. Dr. Hugh Katz is a researcher at Florida State University specializing in reading and dyslexia. He has written multiple books, has published 91 peer-reviewed articles, which I must say is an absolutely insane feat in itself. He's been cited in over 19,000 papers, and he has received over a dozen academic awards for his research as last recorded, which was quite a long time ago, so I'm sure it's higher now. Dr. Nels Duke's work focuses on early literacy development, particularly among children living in poverty. Her specific area of expertise includes development of informational reading and writing in young children, comprehensive development and instruction in early schooling, and issues of equity and literacy in education. She has served as co-principal investigator of projects funded by the Institute of Educational Sciences, the National Science Foundation, the Spencer Foundation, and the George Lucas Educational Foundation, among other organizations. Duke has received well over half a dozen accolades and awards. She serves as a consultant for a number of education and policy organizations and speaks widely on literacy education. Duke is author and co-author of numerous journal articles and book chapters. Lastly, but certainly not least, is Dr. Timothy Shanahan. He is a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he was founding director of UIC Center for Literacy. Previously, he was director of reading for the Chicago Public Schools. He is an author editor of more than 200 publications on literacy education. His research emphasizes the connection between reading and writing, literacy, and disciplines improvement of reading instruction. Tim is a past president of the International Literacy Association. He served as a member of the advisory board of National Institute for Literacy under President George Bush and Barack Obama, and he helped lead the National Reading Panel, convened at the request of Congress to evaluate research on the topic of reading, a major influence on reading education. He chaired two other federal research review panels, the National Literacy Panel for Language Minority Children and Youth and the National Early Literacy Panel, and helped write the Common Core Standards. He was inducted to the Reading Hall of Fame in 2007 and is a former grade one teacher. Before I give the first question, I will just end the introductions by saying that I feel truly honored to get to host this event and speak to each of you. I've been following all of your work for years and frankly, I'm a bit starstruck. Hence a little bit of the nervous stuttering as we speak here. So our first question is, what is the simple view of reading and is it too simple? And I'm going to give this question to Dr. Hugh Katz.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for inviting me. And I'm really honored to be here with the other panelists here tonight to talk about reading comprehension. The simple view of reading has been around for a long time. It's nearly 40 years old. It was proposed by Phil Goff and his doctoral student at the time, Bill Tonmer. And they were working in the midst of the whole language period. And they wanted to draw attention to word reading because there wasn't a great emphasis on direct instruction of word reading. So they proposed a simple view, which argues that reading comprehension is a combination of decoding, which they meant more generally as word recognition, and language comprehension, or linguistic comprehension, they called it at the time. They wanted to emphasize the importance of word reading, and the model suggested that if you use your word recognition processes to turn print into language, then you could use your language comprehension system to understand that language in the same way you might do in a listening situation or otherwise. And it was, as it was proposed, it wasn't too simple. It did what they wanted it to do, and it led to hundreds of studies afterwards, some of which I participated in, showing the contributions of word reading and listening comprehension to reading comprehension and how that changed over time and so forth. But where the problem came is when the model tried to be expanded to an instructional approach that drew attention to trying to improve language comprehension. The model, as you'll see it sometimes presented, is word recognition and listening comprehension are in the same size fonts and the same size boxes. And that gives the impression that the two are similar in terms of it, of their complexity and malleability. Now, we all know that's not the case, but the way things are presented has an impact on people's impression of the phenomenon that we're talking about. So it led to people thinking that, well, we've worked on word reading. Now what we're going to do is we're going to improve language comprehension. All right. And it turned out to be a lot more difficult than it was. The other problem was the term language comprehension is a bit misleading, suggests that language is the central thing that has to be addressed. And I was drawn to that as well as many others. And we had studies in which we improve language comprehension, or language in general, we improve language, and we didn't see an immediate effect on tests of reading comprehension. And that was the basic result that came out of a few of the studies that were part of the Reading for Understanding initiative. And it's at that point where the model is a bit too simplistic and needs to be expanded if we're going to use it for the purpose of instructing reading comprehension.
Thank you. That was great. Is there anybody who'd like to comment on that before I move on to the next question? Okay. So the next question is for Dr. Nell Duke, and it is, what is the active view of reading?
Thanks. Yeah, and I just want to add, I'm thrilled to be here with this august panel, so thanks for the invitation. So the active view of reading is also meant to be a heuristic to help people understand reading comprehension. In the active view of reading, we have the two major elements from the simple view of reading, that is, we have word recognition and we have language comprehension, but we try to unpack what's inside of those two constructs. And we put a construct in the middle that we call bridging processes, which reflects a number of things that are related to both word recognition and to language comprehension. For example, your vocabulary knowledge has an influence on your word reading. It also has an influence on your comprehension of language, obviously. So it has that bridging process bubble in the middle, showing that word recognition and language comprehension are totally separate. It also has a bubble that we call active self-regulation that incorporates some elements that are related to bridging processes and word recognition and language comprehension and to therefore to reading comprehension. So for example, in that bubble, we have use of strategies that people may do to, for example, pay more attention to what they're reading, that influences comprehension. I think to Hugh's point, one of the bar that we set for ourselves in the active view of reading is that every construct we listed, and we have 18 of them, has to be a construct that at least one study has found, if you teach it, will influence reading comprehension. So we tried to hold ourselves to a causal relationship between an element that's listed and improved reading comprehension. That said, Some of our elements have a great and strong research base, and some of them have a pretty light research base still. So, you know, there's a long way to go to sort of understand all of those 18 elements to the degree that we do some of them. So probably if we were really doing justice to the ideas that Hugh was just sharing, we would make the font sizes different to sort of reflect the difference maybe in the strength of the evidence or differences in really the impact of teaching that particular construct.
Thank you. That's really great. And I just want to say that I read your two papers on this topic, and I really found it incredibly fascinating. I loved that it showed just how complex reading comprehension was. There were definitely things in there that I hadn't even thought of in terms of their relationship with reading comprehension. So before I move on to the next speaker in question, is there anyone who'd like to respond to Dr. Duke? Okay. So the next question is also for Dr. Duke, and it's what types of skills and knowledge impact comprehension? But actually, I think you sort of answered that a little in your last question. So in the interest of time, because I do see we have a lot of questions, I might go on to the next question, which is for Dr. Shanahan, and that's what types of instruction most benefit reading comprehension?
Thank you for including me in this as well. I'm impressed with the group you've put together. Let me first say something about these models. I mean, these models really play two roles. One, they kind of summarize a set of research and ideas that are around at a given time. And obviously the active model and the simple model have been put together at very different periods of time. A lot of research has been done in the last 40 some years. But they also, And so they're summarizing a different set of what we know, but they're also they're hypotheses. You know, essentially, one of the things that Phil Goff was arguing in the simple view was that reading the skills that were unique to reading were decoding skills. They were word reading skills, and essentially, if you could read a text aloud and you had language ability, you know, listening comprehension, you'd be able to understand, you know, whatever you could read. And you know, that was the basic hypothesis. And so it was really a kind of Occam's razor to get rid of ideas that people had about reading that frankly hadn't been tested and variables that really didn't necessarily belong in a model. And I would argue that, you know, what Nell was just describing about some of those variables that would be in very small print, those are kind of hypotheses for the future. Those are things that really could turn out to be very important, but maybe we don't know that important yet. And so, you know, those parts that are really solid and would be in really big print are summaries of existing research, and those ones in small print are kind of hypotheses for the future. And some of those could end up in big print, or they could disappear altogether. And that's what I think about those models. And so they serve a different function, and it's really hard to look at the simple view as still hypothetical because it's been studied so much. You know, what Hugh said about it is absolutely correct. In terms of what kinds of things have been found to improve comprehension, reading comprehension, I'll be specific about that. There are a number of things that I think you're going to ask about that I see as indirect. And so I'll just stay away from those. I think there's some things that really are in the language comprehension mode or the reading comprehension that are much more direct. And those are the things I'll emphasize. And I do think that there are a number of language skills where there's research showing that if you teach those things, you can improve reading comprehension. And language, I will include a number of things. Vocabulary is certainly an obvious one. If you don't know the meanings of the words, it can be really hard to understand text. On the other hand, you know, if you just teach vocabulary, especially oral vocabulary, you're going to miss all those words that are really pretty specific to literacy. That's why I want to distinguish between oral and print text literacy. gee, if I teach the vocabulary from a particular text, it will certainly impact your comprehension of that text. If I teach vocabulary, you know, writ large, well, the impact of that is going to depend on how much it overlaps with the text you happen to read. And that's true of all the language skills. But there definitely is a body of research showing that if you teach vocabulary, you can improve comprehension. Same can be said when it comes to sentence comprehension. There are a number of syntactic skills, teaching kids how to break down sentences and to, you know, recognize the relationships between certain kinds of words in a sentence. There's just over the last decade or so, maybe 15 years, there's been just an amazing amount of research done on sentence comprehension, showing that we can do things there. Cohesion research showing that people can learn to link the ideas across a text. And if we're talking young children, the simple kinds of things are recognizing when pronouns are referring to particular, you know, individuals or objects in a text and seeing those connections. Discourse skills, recognizing text structure, how authors have organized their information. Teaching those kinds of things have all been found in some number of studies to improve people's ability to understand text. And so language instruction in those terms makes sense. Another area where there's quite a bit of research is teaching students ways of operating on text, thinking about text, acting on text that can improve their understanding or their recall, their memory for text, which when we talk comprehension, we're usually talking both of those things. Do you understand it? Do you remember it? Can you take it away and do something with it? And there are a number of general strategies like summarizing or asking and answering questions or monitor, paying attention. Are you understanding this? If you're not, do something about it. You know, there are almost 20 studies of that showing that you could actually teach people to, gee, I'm not getting that. Maybe I should reread that. Maybe I should, you know, look that word up or ask somebody what that means. But there are also, as you move up through the grades and you deal with more sophisticated forms of literacy, there are strategies that allow you to think about the information more the way, say, a historian would approach it or more the way a scientist would. And so I would really say that when it comes to direct teaching of comprehension, those language skills I was talking about and those kinds of strategies or actions you can take, those actions all force you to spend more time on the text, more time thinking about the ideas. And that's probably where a lot of the payoff comes from, or it guides your attention to pay attention to certain kinds of information. And those two big clusters of things are probably the biggest and most important things you can do to try to build comprehension.
Thank you for that, Dr. Shanahan. I'm going to skip around on the questions a little bit based on the answers that have already been given and in the interest of time. But I also want to give the opportunity to respond. I know you spoke directly about Dr. Duke's paper, so she might have a response. Is there anyone who would like to say anything in regards to that?
No. Didn't offend anybody. Great.
Okay. So I'm actually going to throw this next question to
Nate. I would like to add something to that, though.
Oh, for sure. Of course.
No, because as Dr. Shanahan was sharing his thoughts, I think at the end, it really resonated with me about really placing the text at the center. Because I think so often, especially in classrooms, we're still at this place when we think about reading comprehension, it's going to be predicated on the text that you have in front of your students. And whatever that text affordance has within it in the author's craft, you have to know that. And so I just really, I just appreciate that point of, if we're going to address comprehension, the text has to be the center of our discussion, and then we move from there.
Mm-hmm. Mitchell, it's both the text and the relationship of the text to the student and sort of where the student is. And so, for example, we can treat text as very general if we're talking young children, because the texts are fairly simple and, you know, the kid's knowledge is likely to match pretty well with a good deal of what they're asked to read. But just look at something like vocabulary. You know, beginning reading texts are going to have a fairly limited vocabulary, much smaller than the vocabulary children bring to school. And so what you'll usually see is, gee, the relationship between vocabulary knowledge and early reading is pretty low. Of course, as the texts get harder and the kids' knowledge doesn't keep up with that, vocabulary becomes increasingly important. It looks like it changes. What's changing is the relationship of the of that text that's so central to it and what the youngster's likely to know at whatever the given point in time is.
Those are both such great points that you just made.
I think you're probably coming to me next, Nate, anyway, but I just wanted to add the task there as well. You know, what you're asking the student to do with the text and to bring to it. So if you're asking them to look for some sort of literal piece of information quite quickly, then they're going to read that text quite differently than if you're asking them to then go and write a summary or, you know, analyze it in a different way. So that's the third element, I guess.
Okay. So the next question is for you, Dr. Jennifer. And, you know, I said at the beginning of this, I wasn't going to say doctor every time, but I couldn't help myself. I'm too impressed by you guys. And it's in regard to strategy instruction. And I will say this is an interesting topic. I find that the definitions are really unclear in my personal experience. And that when you say strategy in a conversation, a lot of times it seems everybody has a different understanding of what that word means. And I think it's because so many different things have been labeled a strategy that we almost have to sort of label them differently. So I was going to ask you, what is strategy instruction and is it effective?
Well, what is strategy instruction? So how long is a piece of string, I guess? And the, is it effective? Is, I guess it depends, like pretty much everything in reading instruction. It depends on how you go about it. So I guess I wanted to start off by trying to distinguish a bit between strategies and skills, because those terms tend to be used interchangeably and then they're not necessarily the same thing. But at the same time, and this really sort of leads into or reflects the complexity of reading comprehension, it's hard to say which basket certain things fit into. You know, is this a strategy? Is this a skill? You know, comprehension monitoring, strategy or skill? Summarizing, strategy or skill? And depending on whose work you're reading, you will often find people putting them in different baskets because they're so interconnected. And there's also, I think, for particular strategies / skills, there's a trajectory where they start off as something that is done in an explicit and deliberate and conscious way, and eventually becomes a skill through repetition and practice. Lots of different texts, that's something that's done in a much more unconscious or passive way. There are different ways, people categorize them in different ways or use different definitions, but that's the idea. There's a strategy that's done consciously and deliberately, and there's a skill that is sort of something that you just do. But those skills sometimes come from having learned them strategically and explicitly. So something that starts off that you might need to learn how to do or teach students to do is to make inferences. And people, there is sort of this idea, I think that's sort of risen recently that you know, inferencing isn't something that you can teach. I would challenge that. There are this good study showing effect sizes for inferencing interventions. Complicating factor is that almost never is it only an inferencing intervention. You know, so effective comprehension strategy instruction is multi-component. So it will contain particular strategies. So inferencing might be one of them. There's a study done by Peng and colleagues recently, which found that a combination of finding the main idea, text structure, summarizing, that was the most effective combination, and good sort of effect sizes associated with that. There are other strategies that sort of remain strategies because you do use them deliberately and strategically, even as a skilled reader. So writing a summary, for example, that's still something that you need to think about. It still becomes deliberate. You know, it's not, we don't sort of stop at the end of each paragraph that we've read and sort of create a mental summary. We're creating a mental model that, you know, we're contributing to as a skilled reader, but we're not necessarily summarizing that little piece of text. So that's a deliberate and conscious thing. And the same thing with comprehension monitoring. You know, we do that, you know, to some extent ourselves as we're, you know, reading as a skilled reader. If it's something that's relatively familiar or not too challenging, then we sort of just do that, you know, without too much conscious effort. If it's something that's a little bit more difficult, or if we have a task associated with that reading where we need to, we're writing a review article or a response, then we're going to be much more careful about the way that, whether or not we fully understand that piece of text that we're reading. So I kind of, the analogy that I use is with phonics. So it's taught, you know, explicitly to begin with, eventually becomes a skill that you use unconsciously and automatically. But sometimes you still call along on that phonological route and decode words and work and use your strategic knowledge and your and the skills and strategies that you learned in the past. So I don't want to sort of go one by one through all the different strategies, but other than just to say the reason that I looked at this was I felt as though there'd been an overcorrection against teaching strategies in an explicit way. So yes, there were some places where strategy instruction was being overdone to the point of overkill, with no sense of, you know, what is the purpose of this? Where does the text fit into this? That no attention to background knowledge. But I think there's been a bit of a baby out with the bathwater, as there often is, you know, in research and in research translation in particular, there can be an overcorrection. So I feel as though, you know, we've got to sort of come back to a place where we situate these things, you know, in the right place and always thinking about what is the evidence.
That was a phenomenal answer. It's really hard for me not to just constantly shout out how much I agree with each of you as you speak. And I want to commend Dr. Buckingham for taking on that question, because I think it's probably the most difficult and complex question of the night. I'm sure there might be some responses to that question. Is there anyone who'd like to speak to that? I know Dr. Hughes' question is directly in relation to Dr. Buckingham's question. So before he has a chance to speak, does anyone want to?
I'd just like to underscore, I mean, I agreed with so much that you said. I just want to underscore one particular point, which is really the importance of having the comprehension strategy instruction before something, right? So not teaching strategies for strategy's sake, but you're applying those strategies because you want to understand the text, because you're going to try to build knowledge with that text, or you have a particular purpose that you're trying to achieve in reading that literary piece of literature. And I think that's part of what was missing in so many classrooms that led so many people to start questioning comprehension strategy instruction, that then led people to speak out against it or to pit knowledge building against comprehension strategy instruction. And like you, I think that's really troubling, because the research base is enormous for comprehension strategy instruction. I mean, it's just no sort of way I think we can justify, based on the current literature, research literature, I just don't know how we could justify just not teaching comprehension strategies anymore. But I think that in practice, we've got to work really hard to make sure that those strategies are in service of something and don't sort of dominate, so that that's like the main thing that's happening in the classroom context. So I just want to underscore that one piece.
And I want to add on, though, because this is actually the kind of the birthplace of when we said, why don't we have this talk? Because I think for me, it just really gets confusing as to what is a strategy, what is not. Like when I think about sentence deconstruction and you're breaking apart a sentence, is that comprehension monitoring? Is it a fix-up strategy because you're using it when you're confused about something? Or if we're annotating the text for the organizational pattern, is that comprehension? Is that a strategy instruction? And I think it's still very just unclear. And so then when I saw this debate of, well, we shouldn't be doing strategy instruction, my mind said, so when a child is stuck on a sentence and I do sentence deconstruction, I shouldn't do that. I think that is, I'm wrestling with that. Mm-hmm. And maybe we're just calling these things, I don't know if we're just, are we battling semantics right now, because we all know we have to do something with the text to get to the knowledge piece. And I guess I always thought that strategy instruction would be the conduit to building knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, that, yeah.
I have the same reaction you do sometimes. And one thing you do when there's a term that starts having a negative connotation is you change it. So rather than using the term strategy, I've more recently used controlled thinking. Right. So when you're trying to understand a text, what as a reader you do is you have to think about that text. And you have to think about the text in a particular way. And in your case, where you're teaching somebody how to think about that text, you're asking that person to control, if you will, focus on a particular aspect of it, whether it be sentence structure or whether it would be asking yourself whether you're understanding what the text is about or engaging in an inference situation, right? And thinking is at the heart of comprehension. There's a great quote that memory is the residue of thought. You have to think about it to be able to remember it and hold on it and retrieve it and so forth. So I kind of look at strategies as a way of thinking about the text while you're engaged in reading it.
And I think of them as intentional actions.
Yeah.
The things that many years ago, I was working in a middle school. And it wasn't a reading strategy, it was a writing strategy. And the teacher was trying to get these kids to use a particular way of generating some ideas. And this one young boy would not play along. And I went and talked to him. And the reason was, he said, I don't have any trouble coming up with ideas. I know what I want to write about. This is just a waste of my time. It's silly. I don't want, he's 11, 12 years old. He doesn't want to play the game of pretending to use it. Mitchell, you gave the example, the kid doesn't understand the sentence, and so you teach him how to break it down. There are ways you can do that. I can show you how to fix that. He's trying to understand it. He's not understanding because it's hard enough. For years, I've watched teachers teach kids to use summarization and self-questioning and strategies that have a ton of good research behind them on texts that they could already read well.
Yeah.
I can do this automatically the way Jennifer was describing. I can read this and I don't have to stretch at all to get it. Why do I need to stop and summarize? That increases the amount of time I have to spend, but I don't need that for this text or for this task. Make the text harder, make the text more, the task more demanding, and all of a sudden I need to summarize. All of a sudden I better ask myself some questions about it. We teach kids to pretend to use strategies, which makes strategies not look very effective. We want to actually teach them to use strategies when it makes sense. And that means giving kids somewhat harder texts or more demanding tasks to do with those texts so that the strategies actually make some sense.
Yep.
I'd like to just try to summarize some of what was said here, because I think I see some consensus amongst you. And I just, as the teacher, I'd like to try and translate this to teachers. It sounds to me like the old school way of organizing our units of instruction around comprehension strategies may not be the best focus. But instead, as Dr. Brookins said at the beginning of this conversation, centering it on the text. And I think maybe this might be an issue with comprehension instruction in general, that a lot of this might be specific to the text we're reading. And that might be the focus. Could that be am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, and I also like to draw a distinction between beginning readers and older readers as well. So the evidence base is quite different for children who are K-2 and are just still learning to read sentences fluently and accurately, as opposed to students who are working with larger pieces of text. So I think it's important when we're sort of trying to look at the evidence for something, to not sort of take evidence for children, year 3 and up, and think that that will apply to children in K-2, because it won't necessarily. So that's I just wanted to mention that as well.
I'd also just like to talk about the larger curricular context. So for me, what we want to drive a unit is, I agree, definitely not a particular strategy, but it's also probably not a particular text, but rather it's a particular big idea, body of knowledge, or whatever. So we're doing a unit on understanding how birds adapt to their habitats in the context of a unit in which we're learning how birds adapt to their habitats. We're going to encounter a number of texts. We're going to center those texts and in particular what those texts can teach us about how birds adapt to their habitats. And that's going to drive then, you know, the specific strategies and other, you know, instructional moves that we make. Does that make sense?
Yeah, good point, Al.
I love it. Okay, so that last question really engaged everyone. So I'm going to throw the next question to Dr. Hugh, who was supposed to go next. And that is, can we teach comprehension as a skill?
Yes and no. the problem is we sometimes think about teaching comprehension as if it was one of these more skilled activities like word recognition, right? In that case, we learn how to do something and we can apply it in a whole number of contexts. It's kind of like swimming. You learn to swim, you can swim in any body of water, right? There are some things that you can learn about reading comprehension that you can apply across different contexts. But the real gist to understanding what the text is depends upon what your purpose is and what the text is that you encounter, right? And that's where knowledge comes into play. And I don't want to downplay purpose. I don't know if we have time to talk about purpose, but the reason for comprehension, it makes a difference in how you might teach somebody to understand a text. But, you know, I heard Tim, I think Tim was talking about background knowledge as indirect aspects of comprehension. And that's where we may differ a little bit. I see the background knowledge as central to comprehension. It's kind of like, imagine if you're a teacher teaching students in an oral lecture about photosynthesis, and you get to the end and there's five or six students that don't understand what's going on about photosynthesis. Well, the first thing you would do is not teach them a listening strategy, although that would be a really useful thing to do, right? What I would do is teach them more about photosynthesis, right? That the background knowledge is critical to comprehension. And if we want to build people's ability to comprehend text, we have to provide them with that knowledge. Now, having said that, having the knowledge is not enough. All right. I would not downplay the explanation Jennifer gave about strategies. You have to think about that knowledge. All right. You have to think about what that text means in terms of what you already understand. All right. But that background knowledge provides you with a framework in which you can put information. It helps you organize that, helps you predict, it helps you do your inferences. All inferences is adding to the text on the basis of what you already know. You can't make an inference if you don't have the background knowledge to make that inference, or you've learned something earlier in the text that you're going to then use to make that type of interest. So I would think about knowledge as a bit more central. But not downplay the information that we've learned about reading in teaching that knowledge, because much of the knowledge we gain comes from books, right? So we have to attack those books in a particular way to gain more knowledge. But so yes and no.
I want to give Dr. Shanahan a chance to respond, since you mentioned that you might have a disagreement on this, but. I also want to just ask you a follow-up question, because I think I could be wrong, but my interpretation of all of your speech and research on this topic is that everybody agrees that background knowledge plays a role in reading comprehension, and that there's debates on how much role, but I think everyone agrees that it definitely plays a role. So my question that I think is sort of the million-dollar question is, does it need to be built up systematically over a curriculum that is systematic, like, say, phonics? Like, we know phonics has to be taught with a systematic scope and sequence. Does background knowledge require the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's done in disciplines. I mean, we've got disciplines that provide different aspects of knowledge that we have that allow us to work in the world. You know, social studies, history, science, literature, you could think of as a knowledge base as well. And so, I mean, I think of the curriculum, as Nell said, as being central, that what we're trying to do is build knowledge in children. But if it's being done within a text, we have to provide them with some ways of attaining that knowledge within the text, right? And that's where gaining more knowledge about vocabulary, general vocabulary, what Tim was talking about, understanding sentences. Texts often have much more complex sentence structure than spoken language do. The noun phrases are extended and they're subordinating clauses and all that. And that's difficult if you haven't encountered them very, very often. So I'm not going to downplay those things, but if we want to assure that children are understanding what they read, then we're going to have to provide them with the knowledge that allows them to utilize that language and skills to make sense of.
Dr. Shanahan, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah. Hugh was right when he said, you know, knowledge is one of those things that I would say is an indirect. So it'd be decoded. You know, they're both hugely important in comprehension, and yet they're not specifically about comprehension. They're tools you use to get there. I get worried when folks, we're going to teach the background knowledge that you need to understand the text. Quite often what that means is you have to teach kids about photosynthesis before they can read about it, that you can't learn about photosynthesis from a text because you don't have the appropriate background knowledge. Well, what would be the appropriate background knowledge? Beginning science texts tend to define the words, they show you all kinds of things about, you know, trying to explain them and give examples and connect them. So, you know, we see again and again, in terms of just straight up content, like information about photosynthesis or the notions that the kids don't have the right cultural background, so they can't possibly understand this. We have to tell them what it already says, and then they can read about it, which makes the reading just absolutely useless. We don't really know. There's actually, when you look at the body of research on the role of knowledge in reading, and it is a huge literature, and it goes back decades, more than 50 years. There's only one study that I can find where they even bother to look at is the payoff that, frankly, you don't have to read the text as carefully or as thoroughly, or you don't have to build knowledge because the information is already there in your head. You know, I'll give you a simple and a trivial example. Let's say you're going to read a text that has 100 facts about George Washington. You know, he was the first president. He was from Virginia. He lived at Mount Vernon, all that kind of stuff. The person who knows 50 of those facts going in is going to probably end up knowing 60 or 70 by the time they've read the whole thing. And the person who knew nothing might come out knowing 20. They both learned an equal amount, but on a comprehension test, the one person's going to look like they didn't get very much out of it, didn't understand much. And the other reader is going to look like a genius. When what was really going on is you're just testing facts I already know. Now, that one study, that very small study done in the 1970s by John Bransford, found that indeed there was a bit more than just knowing, you know, just the repetition of what you already knew. But that's it. I mean, I think that this notion of let's teach knowledge so that kids will read better. We want kids to learn a bunch of things. We want kids to have all kinds of knowledge about science and social studies and literature, not just so that they can read better, but so that they can participate in the world. But I wouldn't sit down and say, wow, I want kids to read about photosynthesis, so I better spend the next 2 weeks building up their prior knowledge so they can read about it. And that's why I say it's indirect. It would be an outcome of the reading that I want kids to have that's going to enable them to read more things about photosynthesis. But I'd hope for more than that. And at this stage, I don't know how to get that, though. There's some new studies that are suggesting ways.
Yeah, I don't think we disagree too much there, but I would still put the emphasis on knowledge acquisition, that's what we're trying to do in school is acquire more knowledge, and that reading is a mechanism to get at that knowledge. So I agree with you. Yes. I wouldn't want to go out and teach kids a bunch of about photosynthesis so they can understand the text on photosynthesis. I would teach them about that so that they understand photosynthesis, and reading's going to get them there, right? And
it is going to be part of how they acquire that knowledge.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the ways that they acquire that knowledge. That's why I like these content-rich curricula that reading is being taught within, right? And the ideas on acquiring that knowledge and showing kids how you go about extracting the information from the text to build that knowledge, right? And again, I wouldn't throw strategies out because you have to think about that, right?
Right. And
whether you call it intentional or controlled thinking, right, whatever, you really do have to think about what you read if you want to remember it afterwards, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that notion of acquisition of knowledge being hugely important in reading and reading instruction just gives lie to that whole notion that, well, it doesn't matter what kids read about. But, as long as they're practicing their reading, everything's going to be fine. Not if you're trying to build for the future, because the knowledge that kids have will allow them to read something better or worse. The more they have, the better.
I think that we found some consensus.
Everybody was going to want to play. Good.
That answers Nate's question about, the sequential cumulative, building from, the lower grades up to the upper grades of knowledge. It's really hard to make those decisions about trade-offs then between breadth and depth of knowledge, because if you're going to sort of revisit topics in greater depth over a period of time, and this is, to me, I think this is the biggest challenge in a content building curriculum, is what you leave in and what you leave out, because that's a difficult set of choices to make.
Yeah, one of the things I worry about is who's writing those content-rich curricula. I mean, if I would want an expert in the area and an expert who knows something about developing knowledge in a particular area to write it, right? And they could help us, Jennifer, with depth versus breadth, because they have some idea of the goal that they're trying to achieve at some later point in terms of how much you know about science or social studies, as opposed to programs that are being built to teach reading within a context of a body of knowledge. And I don't know. I don't know that those have necessarily been written by an expert in social sciences or in science or whatever.
That really goes to Dr. Brookman's question, which is next. And I really want to make sure we make time for it, because I think it's a really important question. And that is, how do we teach comprehension and background knowledge in a culturally relevant way?
As I was thinking about this question, I think one of the first things that I would love to say is, if we understand that knowledge begets knowledge, it really is, how do I say, disappointing sometimes that when we get to this topic around culturally relevant pedagogy, that we have spaces in which only particular people's histories, stories, perspectives are being told. And then we think about the outcomes of that, and we look at the inequitable outcomes of that, and we wonder why populations and students who may look like myself are faring so poorly. It often makes me wonder, are we really using the research base that we understand about how our knowledge, how our brain learns to read, how our brain builds knowledge networks and those conceptual maps? Are we understanding that culturally relevant pedagogy can actually speed that process up, and that it can make it easier for kids to learn? And I don't know if we just have a restrictive view of what it means to be culturally relevant. And I say that because when you say culturally relevant, people tend to think, oh, it's about ethnicity and it's race. But what about the fact that things like youth culture, and we have children now who are in the digital age, and what they understand, and what does that mean to bring texts and topics to them that they can connect to, so that they can build new neural pathways and new knowledge networks? And I think for me, it's really important that we understand that it can help. We also understand that it's not just about race, and even more that if we think about cultural relevant pedagogies itself and think about Gloria Lansing Bill as being a seminal researcher, the first tenet of it is academic achievement. And so if you're being culturally relevant, just having diverse texts because you want to see the Hispanic child on the cover does not mean that that child learns how to read better. And if the children are still not learning how to read better, then you're not even fulfilling the first tenet of culturally relevant pedagogy, which is academic attainment. And so, you know, I just think if we're going to be more culturally relevant, how do we understand the children in the times they live in? What do they understand about their world, and really make this link between, you know, that known knowledge that they have to the new knowledge we're trying to get them to acquire in the curriculum and the experience that we have in school. So I think, yeah, that's pretty much how I look at it. But I think everyone here knows that it's still very political. And I think because we have a narrow view of what it means, we now have a situation where we have teachers who are afraid to talk about topics, afraid to make those links. And so it's just, to me, I see it as a positive impact. I see it as a way that we should be doing things in school. And it just really saddens to me that we have a situation now where that's actually in jeopardy.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, let me add to my question. If we're going to have people with expertise in a field write the curriculum, they're going to need to know something about the issues you're talking about, as well as the individuals that they're teaching this to, right? So it's not as simple as thinking about how you would build a science curriculum so you understand something at the end. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah, I really think Dr. Brookin's point highlights the need for new texts, new curriculums to be created with both knowledge and culture to be centered in those questions, as well as decolonization.
I think there are
but I could add something there too. I want to make sure that it's not just the curriculum, but the practitioner has to understand their students enough to know how to make the link between new knowledge and known knowledge. And I think that's where sometimes we get off balance with what really the cultural relevant pedagogy is about. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. I would just throw in another point. I think there are a couple of aspects to this, you know, culturally relevant content or pedagogy. Certainly one is motivational. You know, if I can see the connection to me, my family, my community, the people I care about, so on and so forth, it gives me a greater incentive to dig in and try to learn it and connect. And certainly part of the notion of that kind of pedagogy is a motivational one. And the second one is really about what knowledge do we want kids to learn about? You know, what's considered academic, what's considered relevant? You know, why is one topic okay in school and another topic not? And that issue about what knowledge matters is much bigger than any of us have time for tonight, or necessarily even the expertise to address. It raises those two issues, it seems to me.
I see we're running short on time. I know a couple of you need to leave in the next 3 minutes. However, Dr. Brookins has agreed to stay on afterwards with me to sort of discuss the implications of what has been said in this conversation for teachers specifically. And I happily invite anyone who's still in the conversation to be a part of that. But I also want to respect people's time and say, if you have to go, I completely understand. I know Dr. Nelduk has to leave. I believe Dr. Buckingham has to leave. Is that correct?
Right. Yes.
I honestly, I've been enjoying this conversation so much. I wish I could pick all of your brains endlessly. And I thought any one of these topics and questions could have ended up being an entire discussion in itself. I was definitely too ambitious with the number of questions I sent your way. So I do want to really say thank you to everyone who has given their time tonight. I think we're truly fortunate to have everyone in the same conversation. And I'm so grateful to all of you for coming on, and to Dr. Mitchell Brookensory for helping me to organize this event. And no, I will say, just even everyone agreeing to do this was a bit of a scheduling challenge, because we're all in different time zones. So thank you again. And if you need to leave the conversation, I'll let you say your goodbye to the audience. And Dr. Duke, would you like to say any final words before you leave?
Yeah, just really enjoyed this conversation. What a brilliant group of people. Wish I could stay on for many hours, but I can't. Thank you all, and look forward to continuing to engage with you in the future. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Thanksgiving to you.
Seeing ya.
Dr. Buckingham, I know you have to leave. Do you know?
Yeah, I do. I'm sorry. Really, really flattered and delighted to be here. I hope that people who are watching or listening to this feel as though some things have been clarified for them, things that they thought were differences but actually are closer to agreement than they might have thought before, maybe teased out some of the nuances in some of this discussion. So thanks, Nate, for organizing it, and really, really lovely to meet everybody else.
That was definitely the goal. So
cheers. Bye.
Dr. Katz, are you staying?
Yeah,
on?
I can stay on for a few minutes. Give me a break here. I'm still okay. Here.
Okay. Well, why don't we start with letting Dr. Brookens try to give his summary points to teachers from his takeaways from this? Oh, you don't want?
No, I actually just wanted to just continue the conversation, but I will say, I do think it's important that we have practitioners who just want to find some sort of direction of how to go. And I think, if I'm rolling up some of the things that was kind of bubbled up here, is this idea of, we do want to have knowledge acquisition. There is no battle between, knowledge instruction versus strategy instruction. We understand that those things have to work together if you want to build knowledge in students. And I think the other piece that was really helpful to hear is that when we talk about teaching critical words and pre-vocabulary, helping children with summarizing, helping them organize information in text, writing summaries, those are some key things that really came out today that I think that teachers can take away from the conversation. I'm definitely reflecting on it.
I'd like to kind of give some brief thoughts. I don't want to take up too much time because I'm the least qualified here, but maybe I can give my brief thoughts and everyone else can sort of debunk what I've said wrong. So one thing that just really stood out with me is when Dr. Buckingham was talking about how this changes from primary to older grades. That really resonated with me, because when I was a primary teacher, I really bristled when people told me I had to teach these strategies, because my students' texts were so literal. It really felt like their decoding and their vocabulary was the only thing that was blocking their ability to comprehend. But then I went up to high school and I was teaching, grade 11, grade 12 literacy, and they're dealing with these really complex texts that require both a lot of background knowledge and have a lot of indirect language or abstract language. And I felt like strategy instruction was really important for these older grades. Now I teach intermediate and I sort of see a role a bit of both, and it's sort of in the middle. But I definitely felt like when I was in this role of strategy versus, say, more focusing on vocabulary and background knowledge, to me feels like it changes as students change in their age. So maybe Dr. Katz or Dr. Shanahan or Dr. Brookens can respond to that.
The notion of teaching kids how to read has sort of historically taken over the whole ELA world or the whole reading block or whatever. But if the central act that's going to be engaged in is reading text, then teaching kids how to get that knowledge, that information from the text and turn it into knowledge is what the instruction needs to be about, what the task needs to be. And the outcome should be acquisition of knowledge. For years, I've encouraged and tried to encourage reading program publishers. You know, they usually have assessments where at the end of 4 weeks or 6 weeks or something, they test kids on some of the vocabulary that they were supposed to learn. If there was a strategy there, you know, and say they were teaching summarization, they'll give the kids a short paragraph and have them see if they can come up with a main idea sentence or something like that. And those are the tests, but they've just spent, say, 6 weeks reading several selections that had content, and they don't test whether the kids remember any of the information or learned anything about any of the topics they read about. And I've always thought that was a little crazy. Why not put that in? Well, because we're not a social studies text or we're not a science text. I think we're starting to see changes on that. It's taken decades to encourage folks to do that. And so the notion of, if you're going to read a text, yeah, I want you to be able to demonstrate that you used the strategy or understood the vocabulary. But at the end of the reading, I want you to be able to walk away with some information and knowledge that you didn't have before. And if that isn't happening, we're really falling short. Mitchell, you said it earlier. Gee, the text has to be really central to a lesson. And yeah, I think all the way through, text has to be really central. Text content.
Yeah, that's great, Tim. I've been interested in measuring comprehension for some time, being involved in studies, and it's really hard to do because it depends again on what you're reading and what the purpose is and how that test is organized and so forth. And I was really impressed a number of years ago by a study that involved kids taking four different standardized reading comprehension tests, and they looked to see how well those correlated with each other, and it was pretty poor. And the other shocking thing was that if you fell in the bottom 10 percentile on one of those measures, you only had a 43% chance of being in the bottom 10 percentile on one of the other measures. All right. They measure different things, and they measure different knowledge structures, language abilities, and so forth. So, you know, when people ask me how would you measure reading comprehension, I think I'd do it the way Tim's suggesting. What I would do is I would teach reading around a body of knowledge for a semester, right? And then at the end, I would ask them to read and maybe write within that body of knowledge. I'd ask them, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be the identical text that they read before, but it would ask, what have they learned through reading in that text? And there is some movement toward that. The one that's best known is the state of Louisiana in a few districts got rid of the state test and replaced it with reading and writing within the, I think it's a social studies or humanities curriculum. And we don't have the evaluation of how that worked yet. Pandemic really cause problems for that, but that's going to be an interesting study. It has a good goal at the end of kids learning the body of knowledge, but it also has the goal of teaching kids to read within that body of knowledge. And what I'm getting more interested in, you know, we're talking about the science of reading, but maybe what we want to pay a little bit more attention to is the science of learning. How do kids learn about a particular discipline, and reading certainly plays a role in that. But, you know, learning is ability to recall that and act upon that, tell other people about it, whatever. And reading is part of that, but it's not all of that. Right.
I do have a question about that. When you brought up the K2 piece, I wonder how well is that going to hold up now that we have a lot of read alouds and grade level complex text in first grade. They're knowledge building curriculums, and you're reading text to children that are at least 1 or 2 years above. And so some of these approaches, we can call them more intentional controlled thinking, still has to happen, you know, within academic discussion, within oral, you know, those oral language experiences. So I'm just wondering, I know you said like the text at the younger grades didn't have meat to them then, but now we have texts in first and second grade that children do need support with wrestling with ideas.
Sure. The texts have changed to some extent because we're teaching reading earlier. And so, you know, when I was a first grade teacher, you weren't even supposed to start reading instruction until second semester. And so the notion that you were going to get into very meaty text in reading wasn't likely to happen. Now that we're teaching reading at kindergarten, kids are getting into harder text and you know, there's more vocabulary and so on. And there's also people are making different choices in what they do as read alouds to kids. They're much more likely to try to go to something content oriented, which I have mixed feelings about because literature carries a lot of content as well. There are things that we want kids to learn from that maybe we're not paying enough attention to. But I think one of the things that we're starting to learn is that if you just read about a particular topic, yeah, that might help you read about that topic. But will that information generalize to other topics that might have some relationship? And what Jimmy Kim and his team at Harvard have been finding is that isn't so simple to get those generalizations. And so if you have kids read about a particular kind of science, generalizing that to another very similar science might happen. But if it's a little bit more different, they don't make the connection. So I can imagine in a social studies class, kids are learning about a war and they learn that there's a reason why the war broke out, and they learn about some battles and so on. When they read about another war, does that give them some generalizations that allow them to read it better? Or do they just go, well, I don't know any of the facts of that, so I don't make any connection? It might be the way we group the texts is going to enable that. It might be that we need to teach particular strategies to teach kids to make those generalizations. I would argue we don't know very much about any of that. We've got a long way to go to know what a knowledge-based curriculum, a knowledge-oriented curriculum really would need to do if it's going to give kids that generalization power that they need.
I can see Dr. Katz wants to respond.
Yeah, you mentioned Jimmy. You know, I was part of a grant that I was involved with, Reach Every Reader, and Jimmy had one of the projects in there. And it's interesting, Jimmy first started teaching reading, right? So his curriculum that he created was a reading comprehension curriculum. And along the way, it changed into a knowledge curriculum, right? But yep. Because he was trying to do just what you said, and that is there anything I can teach kids about knowledge in terms of a schema or a body of knowledge that would allow them to learn another body of knowledge that was somewhat similar? Because he saw that as the way of increasing knowledge. Right? He was teaching them to do it in the reading context, but yes. His mindset changed to where he was teaching knowledge. And I like that idea, but there's not a lot of research on how you do that. We don't really know about how you would move from reading comprehension instruction to, you know, knowledge schema instruction. But Jimmy's was leading the way in that thinking, and I've been really impressed with what he's done in North Carolina in those studies.
I'd love to respond to this because this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and I've actually in my own classroom started to take more of a knowledge building focus, and I think I've been slightly critical of this idea, not because I'm against the idea, but I'm worried about the strength of the claims that are being made on the transfer effect of building knowledge in terms of reading comprehension. I think it's obvious that having knowledge of a specific text before you read it improves your understanding of that text. I think that's inarguable. But I worry about the strength of the claims. And actually, my main reason for being worried, I'm a history teacher, actually. That's what I'm trained in. And is that I worry that if we have studies 10 years from now showing that the transfer effect wasn't as large as assumed, then that people will be like, well, we shouldn't be teaching social studies or science or history. And I feel like we should be teaching these subjects for their own sake. And I worry about what are going to be the long-term implications if we say we're teaching this for reading comprehension.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. But for the life of me, I can't think of any reason, whether you're a big strategy person or you're emphasizing language in your reading instruction, what is the argument against having kids read in substantial text as the what they work on the in those reading assignments and making sure that they come away with knowledge of the content that they read about? It doesn't necessarily take much more time or any more time to do that. It just means that you get two things for the price of one.
And in their earlier grades, Tim, it's the same teacher.
Yes,
right?
Yes,
it's the
yes.
same teacher that would be teaching them about social studies if the curriculum allowed that to happen, that's teaching them about reading in a set of passages that differ from one day to the next. So, you know, what I'd say to you is, being a history teacher, teach history. But in the context of teaching history, teach kids how to read a history book so that they come away at the end with knowledge that's transferable. Right.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit different than the listening, because reading is something that the reader can control. It's a little bit harder to control the listening situation, right? And so the reader has some ability to use that text to acquire that knowledge if they're skilled at doing so.
Yep.
Yeah.
That example I used earlier, the George Washington text, was trivial and was meant to be trivial. It was just meant to make the point. But the fact of the matter is, we want kids to do more than just get a list of facts from a text. We want them to come away with, yeah, facts, of course, but more importantly, some kind of generalizable structures that they can use to apply to other kinds of information that they might confront.
I have one last follow-up question for Dr. Katz. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Dr. Shannon.
I do have to go.
You do? Well, would you like to make any final comments?
I'm impressed with the team you put together to talk about this in terms of their professionalism, and also the consensus that seemed to be on pretty much every point, that I think there's really strong agreement within the research community. Whether there is in some of the folks who are trying to guide practice, that's another issue. But with that, happy Thanksgiving.
Tim, it was great talking with you, right? We haven't had enough chances to do that in our careers. So appreciate
it. Hope we get some more.
Yeah, appreciate it. I got to go too, Nate. But if you got a question, if you have.
Thanks, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right.
Would you want to say any final words, Dr. Katz?
No. I think it went better than I thought. Right? your list of questions were long and a bit redundant, but it's nice to see that differing opinions, have something that they coalesce around. I mean, there's still different things we worry about, and that's a good thing as opposed to a bad thing. And it's the backgrounds that we bring. So. Thanks for organizing this. And Mitchell, I think we've been in a session together before, I think at a conference, and it's good to see you again.
We surely have, yes. This is a really, really good, great conversation. I'm really honored to be a part of it. It went really, really well.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Katz.
See you later.
Are now there's just two of us. I'd like to give you more time to speak. I did not mean to leave you towards the end here, but you said something to me a couple weeks ago that has really resonated with me, that I've been actually mulling over my head, and it's the importance of finding a mental model when we're looking at comprehension, especially as we get towards those older grades. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, you know, I think it really relates to what we just kind of talked about and how I think about that mental model. I think about knowledge acquisition. So it's this concept of when you are finished with the text, what profound understanding, what essential meaning, what core idea, what aspect of knowledge did you glean? And the instruction has to move children from there, right? And I think not from there, but to there. And when we understand like levels of understanding, like we know that first level is all about lifting words off the page. And that is that decoding aspect and word recognition aspect and being able to, you know, first situate what's happening, right, from a literal understanding, then moving into that tech space where you do begin to actually realize like there's core ideas and abstract ideas that are emerging in the text that your background knowledge is starting to be, you know, alerted because as you're engaging with the tech, it's making you think about concepts that you know. And that's a part of that journey. And of course, like once you are engaged in that journey of seeing those ideas, you know, come together, you then end at that final stage of that mental model where you now say, or your mind creates this. So this is what this is all about. You know, this is the knowledge that I gain or the profound understanding that I take from it. So I just think that if teachers would get to a place where are you taking children through those levels of understanding, like is the instruction guiding them there? Are you strategically building that over time? And sometimes with these grade level complex texts, you already know that this isn't a one day process. It will take multiple days, but your aim, and that's why I said like it really links to what we've been talking about, but your aim is knowledge acquisition. That child should leave that text having learned something that is new, that they're adding to their repertoire or, you know, their mental web of or their schema. So
yeah, I kind of see this as the purpose of main idea in summarizing. And that's why I sometimes get concerned about the strategy conversation. And some people view those as strategy. I don't really personally view these as a strategy, although you and I have had this conversation before and you would sort of argue it is, I think. But, you know, at the end of a student reading something, I would want them to be able to summarize what they've read. And I would want them to know what the main idea is. That doesn't mean that I would necessarily organize units around main idea. I don't have like a main idea unit I teach anymore or a, or a summarizing unit I teach. But at the same time, I do on a regular basis ask students to find the main idea in a text. I don't necessarily use that word, but or ask them to summarize something, because I think it's important that students get a lot of practice over their academic career doing that, especially, I think, actually in the intermediate grades, to be honest. I think that's a really important time for them to do that task.
And I don't think we disagree. I don't advocate for the main idea week or advocate for the main idea unit. But I do understand that there are processes that you have to go through to get to the main idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that teachers need to teach that to students. Like, are you teaching students to take note of these repeated ideas that happen in text again and again and again? Right. And if that is happening repeatedly, it's that process of them taking note of that, them holding that information and them seeing the through line in the text. I think that is something that children need help with. And summarization is a part of that. Like as you're reading particular pieces, do you stop at that excerpt, summarize so that you can see the ideas that are bubbling up and you can kind of create, you know, that mental representation, right? So I don't think we disagree. I think that's why we're saying, is it a skill? Is it a strategy? But at the end of the day,
it's semantics.
Does it matter?
I agree. It doesn't matter if it's a skill or a strategy. I only bring it up because sometimes, you know, people will lump that in with like metacognition strategies of like rereading or pausing. I don't really see them as too related. One thing that, you know, you and I have discussed too, I think in private, is just the role of writing and communication. Because I think so much of what we interpret as being comprehension is actually just writing. What do you think?
Or we've talked about the, just because the child couldn't, doesn't have that expressive language, it doesn't come out in writing, doesn't necessarily mean they don't understand it.
Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting because now we are basically at a place where we are literally assessing kids on how you write about the text. And then we're saying that they don't write a certain way and they don't, and they can't, you know, express it. Well, that means that's something about, you know, that's a limited comprehension that they have. And we don't know if that's necessarily true.
I 100% agree. Like, to be honest, I typically teach comprehension more as a writing skill than I do as like a reading skill.
Yep. Because it's hard, you know, when I was a teacher, this may sound really crazy, but I used to, of course, you know, you have the kids doing their table work or partner work, right? And they're discussing the text, they're, you know, completing an organizer. I would actually have a notepad and I would go to the tables and I would just sit and listen to the kids talk. And I would take note on what they were talking about, the ideas that surfaced. And then I would go back home, the nerd in me would say, okay, that child really gets the essential meaning. So like, that's really a level four for me. And I would put a level four there. And if the child was like giving too much like literal, like regurgitation of the text, I would write, you know, I'm writing what the child says and I would code it as a two. Mm-hmm. And I actually started to use that as a part of my assessment system in my classroom. And like parents would say, what is this oral reading grade you're giving? And it was really me assessing their conversation and the depth of their conversation, because I thought that, you know, as a third year teacher, I thought that that was a way that you're supposed to like capture kids' understanding of text.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually really, really smart and logical. I've long thought oral comprehension, like if you read a text aloud to a kid and they tell you what it means, I've long thought that's a more accurate representation of comprehension than having them read it and then write what their thoughts are, because then we have two things in the way of their comprehension. We have their reading skills, like can they lift the words off the page? And then we have their writing skills, can they communicate their thoughts? And that just seems to me like removing, you know, we're two steps away from measuring what we want to measure there.
But is it, when you were talking, I began to think to myself, is that really a problem, or do we need to change how we're reporting out how kids are doing? So what if you could do this as an oral response, X, Y, and Z particular evaluation, but then you can separate what oral versus reading versus writing?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. I think that gives the most accurate measure. Although then again, we run into the issue of the classroom teacher of, what do we do with time? Time is always the number one barrier, right? So what were your biggest, like, what would your biggest instructional tips be to teachers? Like, how would you advise teachers to think about reading comprehension?
You said it earlier. I think the more teachers spend time in the text, really internalizing the author's craft, the core ideas, how that text is organized, understanding where shifts in complexity may happen. I think teachers first have to do that work so that they can know how to help children navigate that experience. Because if you're teaching something that's very complex, we already know that our children are going to need some sort of support with that. So I think that first step is really internalizing the text. But some of the basic stuff of like, what are the activities that teachers may want to do? I would definitely say, I actually believe in pre-teaching some of those critical words that, you know, that is essential to get them to that core idea of the text. I think also using, you know, organizers to help kids organize information. So after you've read a text, let's organize it based off of like the text structure. If this is a cause and effect text structure, then after this text, let's organize, what are the facts we know about? What were the key causes that causes X, Y, and Z to happen in the text, the effects? I can also see summarizing, like you said, how are you supporting children in orally summarizing things before you ask them to write? Okay. So what is the oral gist? and then support them in writing that gist. And then, you know, one thing that's really been hitting me lately is because comprehension is really, you know, it's an output of, you know, it should be an output of knowledge. I think our kids are really struggling with coming to grips with like inferential thinking, abstract ideas. And we've talked about this before. And so I would really be trying to push teachers, as you are reading text with kids, how are you helping to distill ideas, abstract concepts? Because like, that's the whole purpose of reading. You want to have that interchange. You want to see, you want kids to walk away with something more than they can decode the words off the page. So I think teachers spending a lot of time in helping children flesh out ideas that that are emerging in the text would be really helpful.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I will say for me, one of the biggest ones actually was one you said, is pre-teaching the difficult words in text we're going to read. Whenever I do a repeated reading, I'm always starting off with a vocabulary lesson specific to what we're looking at. And if it's a difficult background knowledge topic, I tend to extend after we're done the text and talk about the background knowledge in the piece, try and help explain what they might have struggled to understand. And sometimes I try to do that in advance. It's not like I have a unit structured around that where, you know, I'm pre-teaching a whole list of vocabulary every day specific to one topic per se, but it's more of it as I teach text, I'm unpacking that specific to the text. And that's part of why I really like that you said we got to center it around the text. Similarly, I think, you know, strategy instruction is great, but again, centered to the text and even centered to the student. Like, I don't know that I would do 2 weeks of metacognition strategies in a classroom, but if I was working one-on-one with a student and they're struggling to understand, I might be like, can you reread that for me? You know, or can you pause here? What do you think that means? And model those metacognition strategies. But I also think that it's
funny that you say that, because I find that many times addressing the vocabulary, addressing the fluency piece, and then doing like almost a quick background knowledge, like insert into the lesson of, okay, so let's talk about this concept, build you up really quick, make sure you understand the concept, now apply it.
Yeah.
Right in that moment, I find that those three things tend to really erase not when you say erase, but kind of handles some of the major issues that children have when it comes to the text.
Yeah, I agree. I think it covers a lot just doing that alone. I'm trying to submit research for peer review on this topic. I'm in that process. And when I looked at specific texts, that's where we saw the biggest impact was vocabulary and background knowledge. But it was specific to the text at hand. I will also say that I think looking at a variety of texts is important. I think that kind of came up in Dr. Shanahan's conversation. You know, he was saying we need to include more knowledge-rich curriculum, but we can't also remove rich literature. Although I think how we find rich literature is difficult. You know, one thing that came up to me recently is I was rereading Fulderman's meta-analysis on this topic, and I didn't notice this the first time around, but she showed that there was twice the comprehension outcomes from nonfiction texts as there were from fiction texts. So I think that means it is important to focus on nonfiction, but at the same time, understanding a fiction text in my mind is different than understanding nonfiction, because nonfiction tends to be very literal, whereas fiction tends to have more things like metaphors and similes and complex themes. And I think strategy might be more important for fiction text than it is for nonfiction.
I think, like for me, when it comes to nonfiction, I think what makes it challenging is, yes, it is literal, but the challenge piece is that you need to track relationships. And so if you don't track relationships, you don't understand how to compare them, you don't understand how to evaluate them, you don't see how things are connected. I think the literature piece too is important, because as I said to you before, sometimes the very things that we want children to give in their interpretation are those abstract ideas, those central ideas that you learn by reading literature. Like you don't necessarily learn those necessarily as easily through nonfiction, but the literature, you're going to learn about perseverance. You'll learn about resilience. You'll learn about risk-taking and bravery. Like those are critical concepts that they're like cross-cutting. It's not just about reading. It's about how you interact with people and humans in our world, right?
It's developing you as a human being.
It develops your identity, right? That's part of identity development. So I agree with you around, like, we shouldn't be taking literature out, because especially if you think about children now and our youth and what they're going through, the experiences that they have, like the we now have mental health issues that are running rampant. And literature can be a very critical place of helping them wrestle with those internal conflicts and developing their identity. So
it can also be a bit of a security blanket, a bit of an escape for struggling students.
Yes.
The last thing I would point out is actually giving kids a variety of what we call comprehension questions. And, you know, some people call comprehension questions a skill, a strategy, whatever it is, semantics, as you pointed out to me. Not necessarily organized at a unit, but we do want to give students a lot of experience with these questions. And I think you're right that it needs to be central to the text. You know, asking kids the main idea as they read children's fairy tales. Yes, they have morals and themes, but like they're pretty explicit, those texts. So I don't know that I would give a lot of like deep philosophical questions for these earlier questions, texts. But, you know, similarly, you shouldn't be giving a fiction text and ask, or nonfiction text, and asking them to find an example of a simile or a metaphor or a symbolism. You know, like anything that's comprehension related in terms of a question, I think it's got to be specific to the text being read. So you have to have read it in advance yourself. I think what would be the best question to ask students about this text? And, you know, maybe it's a knowledge question when you're asking them about a nonfiction text. As you know, Dr. Shanahan pointed out, and maybe when we read a poem, it's what is an example of symbolism from this text. But I think we do need to give them a variety of experiences with different texts, different types of texts, and different types of questions, so that we prepare them for a variety of situations as hopefully they progress in their education.
Now, as you were sharing that, it is really interesting how we talked about earlier, like the question types and how you're assessing comprehension. And to ask yourself this question as a teacher, to say, what is the knowledge that a child should gain from reading this text? And is my comprehension assessment giving me that information? Right? Because is it really about these discrete facts, or is it really about this relationship or this abstract idea? And how do you ensure that, you know, because I've seen the test where you're testing something's a simile or a metaphor. But the truth of the matter is the author used that metaphor to present an idea.
Yeah.
So like,
is it valuable?
Does your test actually make sure that child knows that? Or if it is the respiratory system, are you given a test to make sure they know the components of the respiratory system? I think that's a shift for teachers to think about.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. I think that's a really good place to end it. And if you have any final thoughts, no. Okay. We talked the topic to death. Okay. I'm really glad that you helped me organize this, and really grateful for you coming on the podcast to share all of your wisdom and insight and knowledge. So well,
this was
so
fun.
Much. It was fun.
Are you I think you could edit out certain parts and kind of piece it together now that I'm looking at like how the conversation went. Because there were some
that would require knowing how to edit.
Because I'm thinking like there were some things that happened after the conversation with, you know, Shanahan and Katz that like, oh, that was a good snippet that can be brought in, but you don't want to have like the 10-minute the 10-minute, I guess, you know, the break between when everybody was leaving versus when that conversation got started.
Yeah.
You know how to edit.
I'll actually just end the podcast on the final note. The reason this podcast is sometimes full of bloopers is because I don't know how to edit. I'm incredibly non-tech savvy.